You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 30th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, assistant professor of history at Florida State University, author of Stranger Danger, Family Values, Childhood, and the American Carceral State. Paul Renfro will be here today. Also on the program, despite its vow, Russia continues to bomb in the Kyiv area, but negotiations seem to be progressing. Meanwhile, European cities expel Russian officials as Poland ends Russian oil imports. Susan Collins announces she will back Ketanji Brown Jackson for Supreme Court seat. Maserati Joe Manchin, senator from self-enrichment West Virginia, shuts down Biden's wealth tax because, of course, he does. CDC, at this very moment, doing its 60-day statutory Title 42 review to determine whether to extend it. Sinema and Kelly call for its extension, and so doesn't Manchin for some reason. Madison Cawthorn's coke and orgy revelations apparently have gotten him in hot water with his Republican leadership.
Censorship.
Totally.
There's one rule about Coke and Orgy Club. Never.
Biden signs a federal anti-lynching bill. California has a reparations task force to study the issue of reparations. Come to a report by the end of the year. They vote to limit reparations plan to the direct descendants of slaves or free men in this country, black men or women in this country prior to the 1800s. Trump calls on Putin for release of dirt on Hunter Biden.
PJ, please.
And there appears to be some progress on a COVID relief bill. All this and more on today's program. We should say that COVID relief bill, we're starting to see numbers pop back up in this country. And I am headed off to get my second booster later this afternoon because am privileged by my advanced age.
They call it the boomer booster.
The boomer, non-boomer booster. Emma Vigeland is here. Emma, it's time for your catchphrase.
It's hump day.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. She coined it.
Rip the Band-Aid off.
Yep, there you go. And I will be getting my booster.
Boomer boost. Because it's not like boom or bust. Boomer boost.
Yes, except for I am not a boomer.
Mm.
People who are age 50 are not a boomer.
We don't know.
I'm a little bit more advanced than 50-year-olds. Yeah, there you go. So I'm not going to reveal my age because it's a big secret.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why
we can just say I'm over 50.
Right. We can't take your claims.
I mean, it's amazing when you look at history.
Yeah. I'm actually closer to 60 than I am 50. Yeah.
Well, that means you could be a boomer. You could be.
I guess theoretically, yeah. Mm. But I'm not. But I'm not a boomer.
Only in spirit.
1966, not not the year of the boomers. That would be, I mean, the boomer generation are babies that were born in the wake of World War II when, you know, supposedly people came back or they're from fighting, or there was a sense that like, better days are ahead of us. And so that spurred, but I mean, that a 21 year delay.
I feel like Kennedy assassination kind of could mark. I'd be okay with that marking Gen X.
The start of Gen X?
Yeah, and the end of
Isn't
the
it like 63 or 64?
I don't know what the official is. But
I'm not sure either. Nevertheless, unimportant for all of our purposes today, except for the edict in which I say that you're not allowed, of course, to say that I'm a boomer. Now, this is consistent with a, I will say, with critique I have been receiving. I will read this. From that Substack guy.
Oh, yeah.
Ronald Reagan.
I'm a subscriber to said Substack now, just so you know, but you can't fire me because I'm saying it publicly.
Yeah, there you go. You get the special provision of if I had said it publicly, I don't get fired by it.
Well, no, I have the protection of the audience.
It's from the Substack Pause It. R.I.P. Freedom of Speech.
I thought we weren't going to say this guy's name on the show anymore.
But, yeah.
I don't want to be accused that of shadow banning him.
As some of you are aware, I prepared an expose of Sam M.S. Dienceder for the Majority Report live show in Brooklyn last weekend. He's combined Sam MSNBCder with also Dienceder.
Yeah.
And so it's MSDN Cedar. It's sort of amazing that nobody has come up with that before.
It's a compact joke, yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
For the Majority Report live show in Brooklyn last weekend, I worked tirelessly on this project, not for fame or fortune, but in pursuit of the truth. The final video was about 8 minutes long. Yeah, it was. In it, Sam Cedar reveals his ties to Henry Kissinger, his disdain for the audience, and the truth about who is pulling the strings over at the Majority Report. Unfortunately, just hours before the show, a belligerent Sam Cedar contacted me and insisted the video was too long. I told him I was in the middle of a family emergency, and he responded that he didn't care. The video must be edited. It's hard to make cuts when the truth is your northern star. But I was able to get the video down to about 4 minutes. This shows you exactly what liberals think of the First Amendment. In yesterday's Majority Report, Sam claimed the full video would be released. But when? He was short on details. I guess we will have to wait and see when his MSDNC handlers decide to release it. Because we know who is really calling the shots over there.
Well, luckily we got an email from Peacock this morning. So we do have a firm date.
That's right.
Yeah,
MSNBC and the DNC have conferred apparently, and they sent over an email to me with a requirement that on Friday we will play it. We're not, you know, I realize like if I say this, everybody's gonna be like they're definitely doing something, but we're not gonna do a. We're gonna have a special sort of April Fool's show, but it's not gonna be a. We're not gonna create something new. Still. I think we're still probably a year out from that. Maybe for Halloween, we'll do something like that. But what we are going to do is we're going to play that Ronald Reagan thing only because my handlers have said to do it because it's becoming now apparently a political liability for MSNBC and the DNC. Mm-hmm. So we will be playing that on Friday. We will also play another video from this right-wing troll that people are familiar with. It's a short video, but talking about the Boston show. And then we will play a repeat of one of those shows that we did for April Fool's way back when that features Michael. That's that.
Yeah. I just have a note on Reagan's style there. When you – just to go in with the rest of the cohort of these sort of – Substack crew, when you use a word like belligerent, add a phrase like disgustingly belligerent in front of it, or like the word disdain, say putrid disdain, and then you'll just about have it.
That the use of adjectives is
hilarious,
but also crucial in making the point.
Everybody understands that to take down DNC cucks, you have to use more adjectives
for the
than
human
normal.
Container.
Right, right. To fill up. And, and adverbs as well.
Yep,
exactly.
Yep. You got to get really into it. You got to be very flamboyant, as they say. We announced yesterday at the top of the show, headlined, that Mayor Jayapal had been able to secure a hearing from the House Oversight Committee on, I think it's specifically on universal health care. This was taken as an opportunity by the progressives in the House to promote single-payer health care. There is another thing that's going on that John Walker over at the American Prospect has written about. There were expansions of the Affordable Care Act subsidies, which allowed for about an extra 3.5 million people, more or less, to get health insurance who otherwise wouldn't be able to. Walker gave an example, I think, of a 60-year-old woman who is now paying started her own business, paying $93 a month for her health care. When these subsidies sunset, which nobody anticipated they would because people thought that they were going to do Build Back Better, which included these subsidies, her health insurance will jump to $1,500 a month. And, of course, in the just to show you the political brilliance of Democrats, she will get a notice in October when it's time to go into the open enrollment that your cost is going to increase by $1,200 or a month.
What's the month after October?
That would be November, which is, in fact, this year when elections are.
Ah, you know, they must have just got confused and thought that this was one of the years when elections weren't in November.
It just, you know, for those people who think that Democrats do this on purpose, just walk through the whole thing in your head and figure out, like, why that may not be the case. Why this is just, like, an incredible amount of incompetence. Because why would they expand it in the first place if they're not going to take electoral advantage of it? Because they're idiots. The leadership is horrible. Anyways, here's someone who is not horrible. Representative Katie Porter. And talking to the Commonwealth Fund Vice President, Dr. Sarah Collins, about using some props to visualize the disparity between how much private insurance companies spend on marketing relative to Medicare.
Dr. Collins, what percentage of revenue do private insurance companies spend on administrative costs?
You know, between about 17 to 18% of spending in private insurance plan.
So if I pay my insurance company $100, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, $17 go to administrative costs. What about Medicare? What do they spend on administrative costs?
Yeah, you know, that range is about, you know, 3 to 5%
3 to 5% About 3 to 5% right here. And if we look at just billing costs, just billing and insurance costs, Medicare is at 1%. Wait, private companies spend 17 times more on administrative costs than Medicare? What are private insurance companies spending on that Medicare is not? Does Medicare spend hundreds of millions of dollars on television advertisements like private insurance does? Dr. Collins?
No.
Does Medicare spend millions of dollars on stock buybacks to shareholders?
No.
Does Medicare spend money on marketing? Private insurance likes to put its name on stadiums and PGA tournaments. Is there a Medicare arena?
No.
Does Medicare spend $23 million on executive pay like private insurance companies do?
No.
We know how much it costs to run a high-quality health insurance program, $1. Out of $100, research shows that Medicare spends 1.1% on administrative costs. We spend $4 trillion on healthcare every year. We could save $200 billion on administrative costs with Medicare for All. And those savings, they could go to expand Medicare. We could spend that money to let patients see dentists. We could spend that money, let patients pay for hearing aids, to help older adults afford eyeglasses, to bring down the cost of prescription drugs, to finally pay mental health professionals for the work they do. Instead, all this money is wasted. We're not talking about paying to keep the lights on in operating rooms or improving the quality of care. All of this money is used to through pay big insurance to push paper. It's death by 200 billion paper cuts.
There it is. I mean, that's, you know, aside from, put aside the question of whether we want to make sure that every single person has health insurance. Put aside the question of whether we want to make health insurance something that is almost invisible, that doesn't require literally hours and hours of weekly, monthly work by people who are trying to get some type of reimbursement. I can tell you, like, you know, how much of my month, well, everybody knows, but if you have kids too, and they're like going to the dentist and they're, you know, we got to take one kid to therapy or whatever it is. Broke an ankle. It is a second job. But even putting that aside, putting aside all the principles as to why you would want Medicare for all, it is far less expensive, not just for in terms of what the government expends even now.
Yeah.
Even now.
And more efficient.
And more and a more efficient, you know, is the driver.
But when you cut out the price gouging middleman, yeah, that's what's going to happen.
And that doesn't even work in the
executives
idea.
Plus all the things that Katie Porter listed there.
Right, but that doesn't even then start to speak to the efficiencies you get from normalizing the cost of medicine across the board. So. It's important to amplify these moments. We have a couple other clips, and we'll play them later in the program. We got to, a couple of words from our sponsor, and then we're going to be talking to Paul Renfro, assistant professor of history at Florida State University, author of Stranger Danger, Family Values, Childhood, and the American Carceral State. It's funny. I was just thinking the other day, like, I haven't heard anything from – we haven't had an ad for Quip in a long time. Why do I think that? Because I updated my Quip toothbrush. I haven't gotten it yet, but I ordered the all black metal toothbrush that they have there because I just wanted to look cool.
James Bond over here.
Totally. All right. Totally. It was like a total.
Does it have a laser in it?
No, but it does have, it's a smart brush. So they, you know, I've talked about Quip stuff for a long time. They are, in my mind, a design company that has chosen to design essentially oral hygiene products, toothbrush, the most amazing reusable flosser. It's amazing.
I mean, jokes aside, like having a heavier handle for your toothbrush must feel really nice.
It feels really nice, but it also, it's like, you know, it fits in my toothbrush stand too. Yeah. So I don't have that problem that you have with other, and the whole point about brushing your teeth is you got to do it. You got to do it on a regular basis. My dentist said to me last Thursday, I don't think you need to come in every 3 months. I think you can come in like every 6 months. Because there was a while at the, you know, a couple of years
you go
ago.
Going every 3 months?
A couple of years ago. When you start to get older, you get gum issues. They want to make sure that you, but now they're like, we can go back to 6 months because your hygiene practices are excellent. Thank you.
Quip brag.
Yep. Quip gets your smile ready, making good habits easy with all the essentials you need to care for your mouth. The Quip electric toothbrush uses timed vibrations with 30-second pulses to guide a dentist-recommended two-minute clean. It is loved by over 7 million mouths. Those mouths include mine, my daughter's, and my son's. They have a kid-sized toothbrush. And you can even upgrade, which I have done, to the new smart motor to track and improve your brushing and earn sweet rewards. I have no idea what those sweet rewards are. Obviously, they're not sweets because that would run counter to what you want to do with your teeth. But I want to get a sense of, like, you know, how well I'm doing and track it.
Right.
I'm a nerd that way. Build your whole routine with even more Quip, like the reusable floss pick or refillable mouthwash. And on top of that, Quip delivers brush heads, fresh floss, and other refills every month from just $5. No extra shipping costs. Great way to take care of your teeth, folks. Only set you get. If you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you're going to get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/majority, spelled GETQUIP.com/majority. Quip, the good habits company. And lastly, sponsored today, My Solar Nerd. Told you the story about My Solar Nerd. Danny was a listener, a longtime fan of the show. He worked in the solar industry, didn't like what he saw in terms of some of the practices that were that some of the companies that he knew were operating under, realized that homeowners who might want to go solar, particularly not just because of the IPCC, but because of just efficiency and self-sustainability, ultimately cost, folks who might want to go solar don't necessarily know how to navigate this. So they don't know, homeowners don't know the options that are currently available. They don't know necessarily that it's possible to retrofit a home with solar panels for no money down. Most homeowners that switch over to solar see significant savings starting in their first year. And this is possible thanks to the Solar Investor Tax Credit. It's at 26% now. It's going to go down to 22% by the end of the year. So you gotta get on this. My Solar Nerd's mission is simple, to help you find the best solar program for your home and make the transition as easy and smooth as possible. What they do is they analyze your usage. They find the best equipment for your needs. They determine the incentives and financing you might qualify for. And then they project manage the process between you and the installers, obtain the permits, et cetera, turnkey type of situation. And some markets, which are prone to power outages, may qualify for off-grid backup solutions. So don't wait. Some of those tax credits and incentives, both on a state level and on the federal level, the 26 is going to drop to 22% at the end of the year. And Majority Report listeners will get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system. So check it out. Go to mysolarnerd.com. Fill out the inquiry form now. Make sure you select Majority Report listener for how you heard about My Solar Nerd to receive that $200 gift card upon installation. That is mysolarnerd.com. We will put a link to both of those in the podcast and YouTube descriptions with a reminder that if you want the program free of commercials, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. But if you are a member of this program and you want the discounts that you see in these things and these offers, just stop by the blog, every day or look at the podcast description for the free show. And I think we have it even in the member show. We put those bennies in there. So check those out because you don't want to miss. You want to get the discount on the toothbrush, and My Solar Nerd, et cetera, et cetera. All right. Got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Paul Renfro, assistant professor of history at Florida State University, author of Stranger Danger: Family Values, Childhood, and the American Carceral State. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the computer. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Paul Renfro, Assistant Professor of History at Florida State University, author of Stranger Danger, Family Values, Childhood, and the American Carceral State. Paul, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you do your book basically in two major parts, maybe arguably three. The first part is where you're looking at specific instances that take place mostly, I guess, like in the 80s, mm-hmm. more or less, and to illustrate sort of use these specific cases as to illustrate the dynamic that was developing at that time. Let's start with those three. And then we should say in the second part, you're talking more about the policy response and sort of like society's response to this. Let's talk about why did you choose Eton Pats? And we should say for New Yorkers, you know, this case went unsolved for 30 years. It was just, you know, they solved it essentially. Like, I guess it was 10 years ago now. But the guy was sentenced maybe 2017, 2016 or something like that. But tell us why. And we should also say that your dog is there and he's very excited to be on camera.
He's very much a lap dog. Yeah. You know, so the discourse of missing children and missing exploited children really started to kind of congeal around the time of the Pates disappearance. And so I think his case is one of the first major ones that you kind of point to. And one reason that I selected that case as a kind of case study was that his father and his mother really became these outspoken activists and advocates for this issue or for raising awareness about missing and exploited children. And the same could be said for some of the parents who were active in Atlanta in the during the Atlanta child abductions and murders from 1979 through 1981. Camille Bell, for instance, comes to mind. She is an early kind of proponent of raising awareness for this kind of particular framework of kind of missing children and missing and exploited children. And John Walsh also, in the wake of his son's abduction and murder, becomes a very visible activist and a victim's rights kind of spokesperson. So, you know, those parents, those bereaved parents, become really important drivers of this movement or this campaign. And their presence kind of in the sources, in newspapers, in, you know, government records, congressional records, and the like, that really kind of alerted me to, I guess, cases that were incredibly important or that helped to kind of propel this panic. So the Pates case, I think, is really one of the foremost. And the imagery that I talk a lot about in the book that is so key in his case, because his father was a photographer, a professional photographer, and he took these just remarkable photos of Eton that were plastered all across New York City and were disseminated through the news media. And the fact that this takes place in New York, in Manhattan, you know, the financial capital, some would say, of the world, and most certainly the kind of media capital or news media capital of the U.S. at the very least, that helped to really kind of propel the case.
So the stories that the three sort of like, I guess, sets of cases tell, it seems, and tell me if this is fair, and we can go into the specifics of it, but the Eton case, or the, excuse me, the Eton Pates case, is sort of shows how this impetus, the impetus coming from the parents, let's say, and sort of out of society, to almost like create a boogeyman out there that deals with basically gay child predators, essentially. And the case of the children in Atlanta, and we're talking about 24 of them, mm-hmm. Shows how race plays into how these stories get disseminated and who is allowed to fall within the sort of like this narrative and not. And then the third one, in terms of Iowa and the paperboys and Walsh, is about how, I guess, these stories travel in some way. And those three elements that are there, we talk about each one of those different elements as we get, you know, the sort of the type of cases that we're talking about that in your research, you know, generated this narrative, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So you hit on race as a key theme, and race operated differently in each of these contexts. So in the Pates case, you have, you know, coming off of the crises that New York was dealing with in the 70s, you know, fiscal in nature, you know, the crime kind of problem that a lot of folks were concerned about, that helped to structure kind of understandings of threats. And, you know, even though I don't think the discourse surrounding the Pates case was explicitly kind of racialized, I think it was something that was kind of looming over the entire case and how people conceived of it. In the Atlanta cases, you have, you know, exclusively African-American children and adolescents and young adults who are going missing and being murdered. And, you know, I should note, yeah, you mentioned the kind of threat of gay predation or the perceived threat of kind of queer predation. You know, that definitely hangs over the Pates case, actually all of these cases, but it operates differently in Atlanta, where the kind of economic deprivation out of which a lot of these victims come, or almost all of these victims come, that serves to kind of explain, you know, their disappearances. And there's this kind of blame that is placed on families. You know, you get this discourse concerning the Black family as kind of inadequate, and, you know, not providing the same sort of structure that one might expect from kind of the, you know, the white idealized family in this moment. And of course, this goes back to the Moynihan Report and, you know, even further back. But there's this sense that because of kind of cultural deficiency, because of poverty, a lot of the children and adolescents who end up being victimized go out to run errands, right? And there's this sense in a lot of press accounts and police accounts that they are actually engaging in sex work, you know, very young African-American children. And most of these are males, I should say. And so the discourse is much different there, where the victims are kind of being blamed for their own fate, right? And the idea is, okay, these folks are engaged in activities that are rendering them susceptible to abduction and murder. You don't have the same sort of thing happening, obviously, in the Pates case, right? No one is casting aspersions on Pates, you know, the six-year-old boy. And the same thing doesn't happen in the Iowa paperboy cases that you mentioned. Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin are the two prepubescent or pubescent boys who go missing while delivering their papers for the Des Moines Register in 1982 and 1984, respectively. And, you know, they're quite clearly kind of running errands, right? They're, or I should say running kind of, or performing a job, right? But there's no kind of implication that they are kind of asking for it, or they're, you know, they are implicated in their own disappearances. And race kind of functions differently there because Iowa is such a white place, and it most certainly kind of shapes how people are talking about the cases. So when the Des Moines Register's editor kind of opines on the circumstances after Eugene Martin goes missing in 1984, he is clearly kind of trying to cover his own ass and saying, you know, this is, you know, because the Register is kind of, yeah, implicated in this, you know, right. It is not actually guaranteeing the safety of its carriers. But he's saying, well, you know, Des Moines used to be a nice place to live, but it's become, it is potentially going to become like Milwaukee, Chicago. And he explicitly kind of points to these places that are, you know, coded African-American and have large African-American populations. And so there's this kind of discourse of white innocence that very much kind of structures how people are conceiving of those cases.
And how did, I mean, you kind of started talking about it a bit there, but how did the overall cloud of like white flight to the suburbs happening around this time, the conception of the suburbs as a place that's insulated from crime and basically just like black people in New York, or not New York, but in urban areas or New York or Atlanta, things like the examples that you brought up earlier. How did that play into that? Because all these things are happening at the same time.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. So in Iowa, especially, you have this discourse of white innocence and of kind of being exempt from the sorts of terrors or horrors that are associated with majority black places. So, you know, in Iowa, folks keep saying, you know, this is such an this is such an ideal place. You know, this is a great place to raise a family. And it is not like the places where you would expect this sort of thing to happen, you know. And I mean, there's this refrain of it can't happen here. I can't believe this is happening here. Right. And so that kind of anti-crime discourse, which gets activated in Iowa, I mean, I think you see this throughout the country, but it's particularly clear, I think, in Iowa, and it's almost explicitly kind of racialized there. And I think, as you indicated, I mean, this is associated with all these different trends, right, concerning kind of racial rhetoric and, you know, white flights, opposition to busing, which ultimately kind of serves to underpin the anti-crime discourse that really explodes in the last two decades of the 20th century.
All right, so let's move on to what the second half, I guess, which is the sort of the response that this in that these cases, and it's obviously not just these three cases, but these are indicative of the type of cases that we were seeing during this era and the way that it was being received by the public. Before we move on to the responses, how was the way that this was received by the public fundamentally different than it had been? I mean, presumably, right? Children were, and it's extremely rare then. It's, in many respects, I think it's even rarer now,
yeah.
Far rarer now, despite the fact that you wouldn't necessarily know that. But presumably there were cases like this in the 70s, cases like this in the 60s. How was the response different and why?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you see in the 70s, I mean, some really high profile cases that are similar to these that don't get framed in the same manner. So, I talk a bit in the book about the John Wayne Gacy abductions and murders, right? Very famous or infamous cases, the Candyman killings in Houston or the Houston area, right? Very similar cases in that these involved, you know, young men or teenagers, right, who are abducted and eventually slain by kind of one sadistic sort of killer. But tellingly, you know, those cases don't elicit the same sort of attention in the media, at least initially, and they're not kind of understood as missing children cases. And that, you know, as I kind of, I think, noted at the outset, that was a descriptor that kind of gained new meaning or new significance in the early 80s. As it serves to kind of gesture toward a social problem. So, you know, there is this fixation on kind of mass murderers, serial killers in the 70s, but this discourse of missing children and missing and exploited children really starts to explode in the early years of the 1980s. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, the kind of anti-gay discourse that really intensifies in the late 1970s, and also changes in mass media. So cable news really starts to intensify, or you know, the 24-hour news cycle enabled by kind of cable news, that really starts to congeal in the early to mid 1980s. And that kind of incentivizes these sorts of stories, or I should say, it encourages a lot of news media entities to run with this sort of stuff if it is appealing to people. So that's kind of one, or those are two reasons or two ways in which I think new attention is kind of paid to these cases in this moment. There's this sense attached to that this is a grave and growing concern, right? Rather than one that, you know, these aren't kind of off, kind of outliers or anything like that. This is evidence of an intensifying, a worsening problem.
I was gonna wait to sort of introduce this that we get through, but I think this seems like an opportune moment. Like, don't you feel, or let me put it this way, my sense is that this is part of that the reason why this takes off, and it's true, CNN starts in 1980, and there's a vehicle for this. But the narrative, the development of the narrative, I don't think comes from the existence of the apparatus that inflates it. In other words, like, you know, that amplifies it. I think, like, you know, CNN wasn't developing the narrative. The narrative was coming out of something. And it seems to me that this is adjacent to the fears that were associated also with daycare centers, mm-hmm. which also took place around that time, and certainly in the late 70s. And that this is coming out of this is not a coincidence that the homophobia and the concern for children was a function of the right in this country, concerned about the change in the role that women were taking, and the way that the patriarchy was being assaulted in some way, and that the most convenient way to address this was not to say that women should stay in the kitchen, although they certainly did at that time. That was one facet of it. But the other is, look at how you're exposing the children. You know, the mother should be in charge of this. Unless, of course, you know, the kids are black, in which case, well, black people have a, you know, that's that dominant narrative that came out of the Monahan Report. And frankly, that simply existed. But how much of that is there? Like, where it doesn't feel like your research necessarily looks at that as a driver of this, because it's not my sense that this comes out of nowhere, that I think that right. There was a concerted, if not a concerted effort, although I'm quite convinced there was, but a right wing narrative that was a reaction to the emancipation of women, at least to a certain extent economically, in the early 70s.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are, I mean, tremendous fears about the stability and the sanctity of the American family, and specifically the kind of idealized two-parent kind of pronatalist family. And so, you know, anything that's deemed kind of antithetical to that model, whether it's, you know, LGBTQ activists kind of petitioning for gay rights and thus kind of supposedly challenging the primacy of the family, that's deemed a threat. And yeah, women going out and working, right? Even though women have always worked, there's a sense that they are kind of newly emboldened, newly liberated, and this is a threat, right? And also, there's this idea that sexual liberation just kind of generally is a bad thing. And that is kind of encouraging people to do things that will ultimately undermine the idealized family. So, I mean, you see this pop up in debates over abortion, over gay rights, as I indicated earlier, in the late 1970s, and this, and the daycare panic, as you indicated. I mean, that's a clear example of folks saying, well, if you kind of mess with this model, right, which is tried and true and should not really be challenged, you're sending your children to, be with Satanists, right? And this is going to be detrimental to not just your family, not just to your child, but to the entire society. So, yeah, this kind of family values discourse, I think, is quite visible on the right, but it's something that liberals are very much kind of invested in as well. And, you know, you see that in this moment as well with, you know, Christopher Lash and other folks who are lamenting the decline of this idealized family. And this really kind of reaches its a crescendo of sorts with the Clinton years, or in the Clinton years, right? There's this huge emphasis, whether it's through so-called welfare reform or the crime bill and, you know, going after deadbeat dads with kind of preserving the family or shoring up the family that is understood to be kind of embattled. And so this issue of missing and exploited children, I think, very clearly fits into that, as do all these other issues as well.
So let's talk more about that, the that response. I mean, you mentioned, you know, some of those things under Clinton that are initiatives that can be sort of like drawn directly. You can draw a direct line between this sense, you know, and frankly, I was also struck too how much the politicians of that era in the early 90s, Nancy Pelosi, for instance, who came to came into power at that time. Every refrain is, we've got to do it for the children. We've got to do it for the children. And in fact, when Clinton was impeached, it was all about, what are we going to tell the children? And this sort of like obsession that developed over the course of those, you know, 20 years, I think, following the mid-70s, we became so child-focused. Not necessarily in some instances, making sure they have health insurance or good education or something like that, maybe, you know, to a certain extent. Yeah. But that was somewhat secondary to this sort of like, we've got to maintain their purity, or, you know, keep their – and this ends up creating a sort of, I guess, the reaction is the increase of the carceral state. I mean, let's talk about that, on how that sort of develops.
Yeah, you see several different initiatives in the Reagan years. I mean, some of this is kind of done through the private sector. You know, Reagan is very much, as we all know, kind of interested in devolution and, you know, bolstering the private sector, the business sector. So you see this through initiatives like the infamous milk carton campaign, you know, which is undertaken by dairies and the like, but in similar sorts of programs. But really, I think the enduring legacy of this is in the carceral states and, you know, at the federal level. And most visibly, you see it with the Jacob Wetterling Act and Megan's Law. And similar sorts of memorial laws, so-called memorial laws, kind of named after missing or slain or exploited children. And so the Wetterling Act is named after a boy who was kidnapped, sexually assaulted, and murdered in Minnesota in 1989. And this gets tucked into the very infamous 94 crime bill, and essentially kind of mandates the adoption of sex offense registries nationwide. And this is kind of, you know, a technology that was adopted by some states earlier, and it has antecedents kind of in the Lavender Scare and the second Red Scare in California specifically. But it explodes once the crime bill is passed. And something like 1 million people are now registered on sex offense registries in the United States. And, you know, I think a lot of folks would say, well, that's a good thing, right? But there's very little evidence to suggest that it, you know, prevents harm from being perpetrated. And in fact, it's kind of an intervention that is only kind of focused on perpetrators after harm has already been committed. And, you know, for that reason, I think a lot of folks are kind of looking askance at it and saying, well, I don't know if this is actually working in the way that a lot of folks thought it would. And it also kind of misdirects attention from the very nature of sexual harm toward children, which almost not almost always, but largely takes place within the home and within kind of trusted institutions, whether it's the church or the synagogue or the school, right? And, you know, so it is, I think it lulls people into a false sense of security, right? And it's something that I think a lot of people kind of consult and say, well, you know, this is where the bad people live, or this is where sexual harm takes place, when in fact, you know, it's broader than that. And, you know, without kind of evaluating that, you're not really doing anything to eradicate the issue, which is a huge issue, right? It's just not being addressed in the way that a lot of people, I think it is through the carceral state.
And how much did the scare, the I guess the fear about the children also drive the drug war? Because it seems to me, having grown up in the 80s, that Just Say No was really geared, I mean, it's ostensibly geared towards society, but it was really geared towards children, it seemed to me. I mean, and Nancy Reagan headed that up, and that was, that it just seemed, you know, more focused on children, because saying to an adult, just say no, sounds ridiculous. It also sounds ridiculous if you're a kid too, frankly, but how much of that was sort of the, I don't know, you know, I'm trying to draw an analogy between like, you know, the politically political body and the armed resistance, you know, like how much of that, Just Say No, which ostensibly is to protect the children, ends up being a, you know, sort of the softer side of three strikes and you're out, or you go into jail immediately, you know, if you're caught with any drugs, that type of thing.
Yeah, I think it's quite comparable to the sort of messaging you see on issues like Stranger Danger, where, you know, you tell children, okay, say no to strangers. You know, this is how you prevent yourself from being harmed. Even though, again, it's not strangers for the most part who are doing these sorts of things. And then the kind of, you know, hard state response or punitive response is, yeah, the carceral states, you know, increasing sentences for various offenses, encouraging people or forcing people to register for life for certain offenses. And in the war on drugs, I mean, which is also very child focused, and I think, you know, that kind of gestures back to what we were just talking about concerning all these anxieties and fears that are centered on the child, which is at the heart of this supposedly embattled family. Drugs are a perfect example, right? And this is also growing out of the sort of moment, the 60s, 70s kind of moment of liberation that you discussed earlier, Sam, right? The idea that children are, and young adolescents are kind of doing drugs. They are turning into bad people because of drugs, because of, you know, the anti-war movement, you know, the hippies and liberation and all that stuff that is deemed antithetical to the American family. That is kind of informing a lot of the messaging on the war on drugs, you know, just say no. But it's also informing, as you suggested, also the kind of crackdown, right? And there's a clear racial component here as well, right, where more therapeutic kind of softer measures are directed toward white families. There's a historian, Matt Lassiter, a mentor of mine, who writes about, you know, white children and teenagers as kind of impossible criminals, right? Even when they're the ones who are selling drugs, doing drugs, the idea is that it has to be the black and brown kind of pusher who has infiltrated the suburbs and kind of forced them to sell drugs, right? And they are redeemable. That is, the white teenagers are redeemable, and you know, the black pusher or the brown pusher is most certainly not, and cannot be dealt with through kind of therapeutic, you know, softer sort of means, but needs to be locked up indefinitely. And that's what happens with so many people, obviously.
We're seeing shades. It's not the same thing, but we're definitely seeing shades of that, I think, with this anti-trans push where, you know, our children are pure white slates. And the only way that they can move to the side of the evil liberals or be a part of, you know, 21st century society, maybe questioning their own identity, gender identity, sexual identity, is if they're indoctrinated by people in schools, malevolent forces. there's less of the racial component there, but that's the same thing. Save the children, and it's just a
CRT.
CRT is that.
I mean,
yeah,
we're living in a moment right now where this is having a resurgence, right? I mean, aren't we? This is all. I mean, this dynamic seems to be playing out. I could look at a half a dozen stories over the past two months that, you know, whether it's Supreme Court justice or whether it's don't say gay in Florida. I mean, this seems to be playing out. There's a resurgence of this.
Yeah, I think it's cyclical. So, I mean, you can look, I mean, the schools and children are often kind of sites of cultural battles, you know, in the larger culture war. So you can look back to at least the Scopes trial, right, in 1925 concerning the teaching of evolution in Tennessee schools. You know, there are fears about kind of so-called juvenile delinquents in the 50s. There are clearly debates over busing and school desegregation in the mid 20th century and into the late 20th century. And even today, really. In the 90s, you saw this great kind of a great deal of anxiety concerning college campuses and indoctrination and political correctness. You know, back in the kind of first iteration of that panic, illiberalism, that sort of thing on college campuses. And I think you see that also today clearly with many of the bills and discourses that you're talking about, whether it's CRT or the trans panic, or even, you know, this is kind of adjacent, I think, but with the kind of interrogation of Ketanji Brown Jackson, you know, the idea that she's kind of soft on crime and thus sort of enabling child abuse or kind of facilitating it. And this is very much kind of a line that Josh Hawley and others have adopted. And, you know, in their mind, it's kind of effective, right? And I think it's of a piece with what you saw in Virginia in the governor's race, you know, the parents matter sort of mantra, right? And, you know, a lot of this is kind of connected to COVID as well. And so it might not be, Emma, as you indicated, kind of explicitly racialized, but there's a clear kind of racial and class component to it as well, where kind of white parents, wealthy parents are more likely to kind of want their children back in schools. And, you know, there's plenty of data to indicate that parents of color are less kind of inclined. They're, you know, in some ways more concerned about safety in these spaces.
I just want to just touch on Alfred
Regnery.
Regnery.
Yeah.
Because this guy is quite a trip. I have a couple of theories about him, actually. But we should also say, like, his publishing house has been like the number one publisher for all the most noxious right-wing books that we are aware of. In fact, they also, I think they also were the publisher who was working there was like intimately involved in setting up getting the wiring of in Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky or the recording Monica Lewinsky. This guy was in the Reagan administration and, I remember Ed Meese and also like talk about who he is. And, you know, he exited places in a way that felt like there was another part of the story, frankly. I mean, I don't know what else to say, but, I have my suspicions, but tell us about him.
Yeah, so Regnery is kind of a classic sort of Reaganite in that he kind of took this position as the head of the OJJDP, which is the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. And like others who took such kind of leadership positions in the administration, or kind of adjacent to the administration, whether in the DOJ, and I should say that the OJJDP is in the DOJ, he was kind of hostile to the very sort of mission of the OJJDP. And more than anything, he kind of used this discourse of missing and exploited children to inform harsher juvenile justice penalties, right? And there's kind of a clear sort of discourse here that he is spearheading, or he is kind of pioneering, that is very racialized, very classed. And I argue that it's kind of a precursor to the super predator idea. There's this notion that so-called juvenile offenders are getting more violent, more serious, less remorseful. And this requires less coddling, to kind of use his language. And it requires, you know, the federal government to really crack down. And he's, you know, he kind of relishes punishment. And there's this clear sort of Manichaean worldview that he's applying here, or into which all these different things fit. So, you know, some kids are very good and some kids are very bad. And usually the bad kids are poor and black or Latinx. And the white kids who are kind of runaways, are again kind of redeemable, and the state needs to intervene in those cases, but not in a punitive way. So I think this in many ways kind of lays the foundation for, you know, so much of the discourse that we see in the 90s, that, you know, both parties participate in, that Hillary Clinton kind of very enthusiastically participates in. But yeah, he's quite a character. I don't want to go into all of the little anecdotes, but, yeah, he, you know, he very clearly kind of, relishes kind of punishment. And, you know, he has these kind of fantastical stories about abuse and violence, some of which are kind of not true.
Because he is such an important figure in so much of our, you know, I mean, he's in the administration at that time, and this is where that history gets. And we've seen people who came out of that era implicate our politics, you know, dramatically. John Roberts was also in that same DOJ. Wanted to get rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and manages to live out his dream.
Yeah. I mean, Giuliani's in this book. You know, a lot of people, as you suggested.
Regenery, my understanding is when he was running for local office in Wisconsin, claimed that his wife had been like home invasion, and had been sexually assaulted, and police came. They found no evidence of any of that, but the guy had a massive stash of pornography, and like I say, this is the time of Ed Meese, where they were trying to sort of like ban all pornography, and he ended up. Then he had like a series of resignations that were like super abrupt. Over the coming years, it just seems to me that my theory is that like this is someone's psychological issues just playing out in projection, which seems to me to have been so much of what drove a lot of the politics at that time.
Yeah, I mean, and to elaborate on that story, his wife had claimed that she had been stabbed, you know, 60 or 70 times or something like that, and all of the marks associated with that appear to have been self-inflicted. And even though the police came, as you indicated, and said, yeah, this didn't happen, the news kind of didn't run with that, right? They kind of confirmed his story, or suggested that there were maybe some questions about what had actually occurred, even though, you know, all the stab marks very clearly were kind of inflicted by his wife. I'm not a psychoanalyst, but, you know, there has to be some projection when it comes to, you know, folks who are so invested in kind of these visions of violence and abuse, and almost seek to kind of, insinuate themselves into those scenarios. Right.
Right. It seems like he and his wife wanted to be victimized in that way, wanted the consequences of said, or I guess wanted some sort of like sympathy or morality assigned to them because they are victimized in some way, and thus invalidating their worldview and manufacturing it. I mean, there's some dark stuff there, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Paul Renfro, assistant professor of history at Florida State University, author of Stranger Danger, Family Values, Childhood, and the American Carceral State. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Fascinating work.
Thank you all so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920. We will take phone calls today. We will take your IMs, which are which you can IM us to, through the app at majorityapp.com.
Yes, we will take calls.
Emma's going to take a quick nap in between.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to yawn. I found the interview interesting.
No, I was implied.
I'm a bad sleeper. That's why.
I couldn't sleep last night either. I don't know what the heck's going on.
I know why I didn't sleep last night. It's Grand Tactic Civil War.
That just comes in bleary-eyed to yeah. this new video game.
I invaded Richmond last night.
Congratulations. Oh, no way. They yeah. deserved it.
It really killed the Confederate morale.
Folks, don't forget, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, if you want to see the live show, ladies and gentlemen, Friday you're going to get a taste of maybe what's going on with that live show. I don't know. Maybe we'll play that. Maybe we won't. I'm not sure. We may have a hint, but the bottom line is, special guest in Boston, May 15th. You can join us by going to majoritylive.com, clicking on the link to the Boston show and getting a ticket. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckie and media universe?
Yeah, tonight we got Andrew Perez of The Lever, formerly known as The Daily Poster. We're talking about a couple stories he's got out. One most recent about the Conor Lamb super PAC that's attacking Fetterman as too much of a socialist. And also the centrist, I forget what the PAC's name was, but it's pharma-backed that's supporting Kyrsten Sinema. And also the Koch brothers. So talking about money and politics tonight, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow. What? What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start life.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. We call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about yeah. you is just like every day, all day, like yeah. everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
just the weak being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.